Hello, hello. Okay, there you go. Well, welcome to the first paper session. The paper session is on live sound and a historical perspective. And, you know, Bob McCarthy took us up through Simlandia earlier today. And maybe we'll move into some other aspects with our talkers today. We have three presenters. We have Johannes Mulder, we have David Sherman, and we have the inestimable Bob McCarthy again. But our first presenter is going to be Johannes Mulder. He's a sound technologist, researcher, and educator. And hopefully he's here?
He's here.
Okay, brilliant. You know, I hate to get so far into the introduction and then have it be like, oh. All right, so thank you for that. Sound technologist, researcher, and educator. Initially trained in the Netherlands as a tone master, he specialized in live sound, working internationally with top performers from different traditions, with a focus on contemporary electroacoustic music. In addition to music and technology skills, he developed an interest in the wider organizational, socio-cultural, and historical aspects of the use of electronic amplification in the performing arts. A master's degree in arts management administration and a PhD entitled Making Things Louder, that's a good place to start, isn't it? Look at bridging the gap between technology, its creative use, and broader discussions of the performance arts and society. Currently, he's a lecturer at Murdoch University in Perth, teaching sound studies and production subjects in the Bachelor of Sound. Please give a welcome to Johannes Mulder.
Cheers. Thank you. Everything he says is true. I am a social scientist. My PhD is in social science. But I am also a live sound engineer. The Tonemeister degree was mentioned, but in the third year I dropped out and I did the right thing. I started doing radios on the theater tour and been touring after that tour for 15 years. So that's why I'm here. However, the paper I've written is rather a social science kind of paper. It's not an engineering paper. It doesn't focus on any of the engineering. But I'm still very keen to present it here. However, I only have 20 minutes. It's a rather large paper. So what I'll do, I'll talk about the paper a little bit. I'll talk a little bit about myself because I know very much about myself. And give you a context for the paper. And then if you're interested, you can actually read it. That little history, what it did do in the end, by a number of coincidences, I worked a lot in the Amsterdam Concertgebouw, which, just to refer to Bob's talk, this is the best of the both worlds of the 1900 and the 1960s design. What did you say? Design space? Design framework? Design paradigm? Whatever. So where the arrows are, so this is the world-famous Amsterdam Concertgebouw. It's a beautiful, if you play Mahler or Bruckner, as soon as you put a band in, it's particularly, it was my nightmare for 10 years, my biggest challenge, very fulfilling. The first PA system that was installed where the arrows are above the loges. So that's about, if the microphone is where the conductor is, that's about 15 meters, possibly even more behind that microphone. So that's the design from the 1960s, loudspeakers out of sight, in the design of the 1900s, best possible acoustics, and stay off those walls. You know, that's beautiful walls. Where I position myself, being researching live sound from a more social science perspective, I see this on the crossroads between technology and performance, or music and performance, and also between society and culture. And there's an important societal element to it that I talked about. I went to the previous AS conference 2 weeks ago in Denmark about music-induced hearing disorders, not the other way around. Because my main research effort goes into the stakeholder dialogues when it comes to sound level management at live events, concerts, etc., which I find a fascinating topic, and I really want to be in there to bring the sound engineering perspective and the live sound engineering perspective, because not all the stakeholders that are involved in those dialogues really understand our issues or our solutions if we have them. Going back to the Concertgebouw, I did a master's in. My frustration was that even I finally had the great line array, and we had great digital snakes, we had great stuff, we had great gear. We still had shit concerts. Yeah? So my frustration ended up being with the people who program the music, or the production managers who forget to inform the musicians that they really, really, really should not bring two darbukas into this acoustics if you also want to sing. So at one point I thought, okay, this is it. What I'm going to do, I'm going to study arts management, and I'm going to work at a venue, and I'm going to create better sound from that end rather than the buying a bigger line array perspective. So I did that, and I wrote my master's looked into the jazz concerts in the 1950s. In the 1950s in Europe, a lot of the American jazz legends toured in Europe because they actually made more money there. But there were very few venues. The only venues that were still standing were the classical concert halls, so they played there. People like Louis Armstrong, that he needed to play, Ella Fitzgerald, a lot of those performers needed to play with amplification, so they needed amplification. I was trying to find out, how did that work? What loudspeaker did they buy, etc. There's a lot of documentation about the performance. There's a whole pile of beautiful letters from the 1950s where people complain about the sound. Two main loudspeakers above the loges there, but they also, with every pillar, on every column under the balconies, they had one little loudspeaker, little square loudspeaker, underlaid. There's about 11 of them in a row. You can imagine what that sounded like. So I became interested in that history, and then if you go to the library and you say, I want the book about the history of live sound, then there's a book, there's many history books, but there's not one on the history of live sound. There's a lot of information on the internet. And what I start to understand, and this is sort of what I try to picture in this paper, is that there is not one main history. There are a lot of little histories. They're very localized, and I'll talk about it in a second. But I think, on the whole, there's a few different causes why we ended up with loudspeakers and microphones in the same room. For instance, larger venues, larger audiences, the first two dance crises in the United States, where you're not dancing with 800 people, but you're dancing with 4,000 people. You need a bigger band, and at one point you don't need a band anymore. With film sound, the first cinemas were just repurposed music hall venues, and they had very live acoustics, didn't really work for the first sound motion picture films. There was a technological drive from the success of sound film. For sound film, people started developing directional loudspeakers and directional microphones, which really improved the opportunities for live sound to amplify a live sound source, a musical live sound source. And there's a set of considerations, like the crooners, they started singing very quietly, and that worked on the radio, but it didn't work in the venue. So something had to be done. And then later on, obviously, the electric guitar, distorted or not. One of the things that drives me in this research, in this project, is if I read books about musicology, if I read books about music of the 20s, 30s, and 40s, often sound amplification or sound reinforcements is equated with sound recording. So as soon as there is amplification in the recording process, 1924, 1925, people then say, oh, this is when amplification starts, so this is all of a sudden that performers start singing with a microphone. Whereas in fact, no, the microphones were omnidirectional and most loudspeakers were all over the place in their directionality, and it wouldn't have worked. So in this paper, and if you decide to read it, I apologize for the language. It is a very social science-y language, and I've only been in social science for a few years, so I'm also, you know, getting my head around all the five-syllable words. I'm much better with one-syllable words. But I want to provide, and you may not agree with any of the things I propose. They're hypothetical. But I want to provide a framework of understanding these little histories, and I want to also find a way of sharing these histories with people in other disciplines, with social scientists, historians, and musicologists. So one of the things I'm really interested in is this sort of decentralized development. If you start Googling, and if you start looking on the internet and look at what sort of histories are there, you'll find a lot of websites, and they're all dedicated to one little segment, to one person, one brand, one shop. Which sort of suggests, oh, so there is all this localized stuff going on. What I thought about that, this is different to, for instance, radio. If you want a radio empire, and this is a nice small country that helps for the diagram. But what you need for a successful radio station or a radio business, you need a central tower that broadcasts your show, and then you need a shop where people can buy their radio, and then they go home, and their radio has to receive that frequency, and you can sort of build a radio empire. If you want to work in the music industry, you need a recording studio, you need a band to press your records, you need trucks to drive them to the record shops, people need hardware to play your particular record, and they can buy your products and enjoy the music. If you look at a few of the shops that were around in the 20s, radio shops. You have a radio shop, you get your hands on a microphone, and you, I don't know, on Friday you're asked to amplify the major speed, or on the Sunday dance. Yeah? So very locally, people start using their radio gear or whatever they can get their hands on, whatever they can build themselves, to start doing a little bit of live sound, a little bit of amplification. And they develop their own heuristics and their own combination of home-built loudspeakers, bought microphones, amplifiers, etc. And you get all these little different approaches where you have many different little histories with many different engineering heuristics and different ideas about what is best practice. How do you solve different challenges? And for instance, when I started working in the Netherlands in the 90s, we still had some companies that had two as hots, and the others had three as hots. And our national broadcaster, all their cables were still female, and everything else was male. Yeah, and if you come in with your live sound kit and you have to adapt to that radio station, you need a lot of adapters there. So, and I think this has the consequence for the typical career path in live sound. Nowadays, if you want to work for a radio station as an engineer, you need to have a proper study, you need to be a properly trained engineer, you have to bring a lot of knowledge in a lot of different areas. Any one of us with only primary school, as long as you can drive a car and speak English or a few other languages, you can become a live sound engineer. And I'm not saying that is wrong, but it is a very different career path. I'm not really sure. I think what we do gets more and more complicated. I think it's really, really hard to do this properly without a proper education. But there's still, with the band, a lot of mixers arrive, and they're not always very well informed about what we're doing or what they should be doing. So that is one little aspect. I think our industry developed more decentralized when compared to the other electroacoustic disciplines, music recording, radio, television, film sound, etc. The other really essential thing, I'm midway through, so I'll drink some water, is what some people call transsectorial innovation. And that's just a lot of syllable words that tell us that some developments from one branch had a big influence on another branch. And if you look back, there's a few of those moments that we can identify in the sound reinforcement branch and the live sound branch. Starting with telephony, Jensen and Pridham, who are a little bit famous for building one of the first working loudspeakers. But what they were trying to do, they were trying to improve the telephone receiver, because telephone didn't sound very good, they were trying to improve it. But what they ended up with was a very, very large telephone receiver, which didn't work very well in a telephone handset. So they used it to amplify, they started playing music outside, and in 1915 actually amplified someone's speech. But their first interest was telephony. Of course, telephony was then a very big business, and many fortunes were made there. And the other famous example is the Armistice Day system. And there's two really, really good papers on that, or very informative paper that really explain what their challenges were, what they were doing, what decisions they made, both from 23. But here, the engineering solutions and engineering challenges were identified by people from the telephone engineering specialism. And you can understand why, if you look at what they did. They connected up these American cities, and if you're... I'm not from America, but I know these cities are quite remote from each other, and they had a speech from one place made audible in many different large stadiums across the country. using telephone lines, which was very challenging, but they made that work. Also, very well described case this. Yeah. So from that telephony project, or those telephone developments, gave a boost or an impulse to sound reinforcement in the early 1920s. The other thing was radio. Roxy Rottafel, who ran cinemas in the 1920s and 30s, and who was very early on the having ideas about, okay, we need electricity, we need to amplify these sources so that we can make our stage shows available to larger audiences and maybe fire a few musicians. I mean, that's always a possibility. But he never wrote that down. But in 1922, the WAAF, the in Dutch I would say WAAF, the WAAF station, was actually broadcasting from the top of, I think, the Capitol Cinema in New York. And they saw Rottafel rehearsing with his stage show, and the radio engineers from Western Electric actually provided him with a loudspeaker and a microphone, said he, from sitting in the room, could address the people on stage. So it was sort of a reverse PA installation, which was the first step. And then in 1925, there's quite a famous article from him in an architecture journal where he says, oh, in 5 years' time, there'll be a musical director and he'll be twisting dials and making the balance and making one violin sound like 25. Another influx from radio, or which I think is a radio influx, which I like to tell a little bit about using Rudy Valli. Rudy Valli was very, very famous as a crooner, but also he was often pictured with a megaphone. Even in a little cartoon from 1934. So he was almost synonymous with megaphone singing.
And like a poor Cinderella.
And what we don't hear now, but would, of course, if I would hear him do a megaphone, megaphone's very, very directional, which doesn't really work for live music. But many people sang with megaphones in the late 20s, early 30s. When did we segue from those megaphones to live sound? That's really interesting. I found this great interview with Valli, which I just play itself.
Did you use the megaphone, your trademark, at that time?
At that time, there was no amplification of any kind, as far as I... The only electrical speakers I ever heard used were in the IBM, subway trains in New York had little speakers, and some of the cars would say, "Watch the door, watch the door."
Uh-huh.
And that was the only time I heard a voice being amplified through a speaker. And, of course, in all the broadcasting studios, outside the studio, there were big sort of radios in the hallways where you could hear the program is going on inside the glass-enclosed radio studio. And I said, well, why can't they have a speaker right in the same room with you? They said, because you'll get a feedback. The sound will come out of the speaker and go back into the microphone with your own live voice, and it just won't work out.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't know that it could work out if you place the speakers in the correct position.
So the point is here, all that radio throughout the late 20s and the early 30s, there were live broadcasts with an audience, with a studio in the studio. But they couldn't hear the vocalists. Yeah. So if you wanted to hear the vocalist, you had to go outside of the studio to hear him sing. And this really changes, I think, the understanding of those radio... For me, it changes the understanding of the importance of those radio broadcasts. In one of his books, Rudy Valli wrote this biography when he was like 22 and a half. But in one of them, he says that before the radio broadcast, he would tell the audience, I will sing the same songs after the broadcast using a megaphone so that the audience locally could actually hear the songs. Which, of course, is they didn't have a system that would allow them to amplify music at a frequency range, 3 minutes, yeah, got it, that does justice to music. And this is, just wanted to point you, direct you to this Edward Kellogg article from 1930, where he talks about reverberation in all the refurbished music hall venues. But he says here, I'm not in a position to say whether a voice amplifying system suitable for application to music has been developed, But we would be in serious error if we formed our estimates of the possibilities from sort of public address system, which we know now. Yeah? So I think what he is saying is that for vocal address, the frequency range was very, very, very much reduced in order to be efficient. For music, that simply didn't work. Although there are some examples all through the 1920s, but they were all not very successful. So I somehow that may tell us that that didn't really work. Bing Crosby, the famous crooner, there's a few of his biographers say that he started using a microphone live in a room at the Coconut Grove in 1930. There's very, very little we know about it, but maybe he had access to one of the early Olsen-designed figure of eight microphones. Because in 1931, he recorded his first I Surrender Dear, his first really big hit, which was recorded with a ribbon microphone. That's hypothesizing there. And then this is where I'll leave. All of a sudden, December 1931, we have Radio City Music Hall, which has this spaceship mixing desk, and they have 40 to 50 of these PB31 Olsen ribbon microphones. They have in all sorts of positions all over the place. They have a lot of different loudspeakers. They have a system for the live sound and a system for the cinema sound. All of a sudden, it's all there in December 1931. Such a big step made all of a sudden. I'll leave you there. Everything else in the paper. Thank you for your attention.